That is the chorus from Viva SeaTac, a song written in London and recorded in Seattle 25 years ago by Robin Hitchcock, and which has become something of an anthem for the region, at least for some people. Robin Hitchcock will be performing in Seattle this Friday night, so our resident historian Felix Bunnell set out to create the unofficial oral history of this somewhat esoteric, yet pretty darn catching, and I have to say, repetitive song. Here he is.
Now, I've been working on this story for months, Dave, so it's going to take hours to get through all the details but I'll do my best. On that recording, are British folk rocker Robin Hitchcock, who wrote the song, Peter Buck, founding guitarist of R.E.M., Scott McCoy, founder of the Young Fresh Fellows, plus Tad Hutchinson and Kurt Block of the Young Fresh Fellows, and a guitarist named Tim Keegan. It was released in 1999 on the Robin Hitchcock album Jewels for Sophia. Now, details are murky. It's believed the song was first played live at the old Crocodile Cafe circa 1997 and recorded right around the same time. Inspiration for the song goes back a bit further to 1994 at an impromptu event, also at the Crocodile, which was called Viva SeaTac, but which was also known as the Popsicle Shop Incident. As I said, details are murky.
Yeah.
And they're no less murky 25 years later, of course. Right. Now, Robin Hitchcock's been performing since the 1970s. He spent a lot of time in Seattle in the 1990s. He loves that name SeaTac. He added Viva to it to come up with that phrase, which naturally led to him writing the song.
As often happens, I have a title and then a song will appear from it. So I was sitting there with my guitar one evening in London and out popped Viva SeaTac pretty much intact in one piece. It was one of those songs that wrote itself in about 10 minutes.
Now, it's a catchy song, but it does have some darkness in it. Let's hear a bit more of Viva SeaTac.
Do you want to pay for this in cash? Viva Seattle, Tacoma. Viva, Viva SeaTac. Viva Seattle, Tacoma. Viva, Viva SeaTac. Viva, 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 Viva SeaTac. They got the best computers and coffee and smack.
So, okay.
Was the content based on which words rhymed?
Yeah, but it's about Seattle in the 1990s. And that line in particular, that do you want to pay for this in cash? I think those words capture the crazy feel of Seattle during the tech boom in the mid-90s when everyone was making a fortune in stock options and buyouts.
I see.
You know, those are crazy times if you were back here then. But Robin Hitchcock says people around the world were noticing Seattle back then.
It wasn't just that you could feel it there, but you could feel that vibe about Seattle. Because grunge and the heroin revival and the coffee, the Starbucks, I think, making it across the Great Divide and starting to appear all around America and then appearing in Britain.
Yeah.
You know, those three things really put it massively on the map. It was like Liverpool in 1964.
You know, the song name checks all kinds of local things like Ballard, Kurt Cobain, Jimi Hendrix, and Groovers coming from Vancouver and Oregon. And speaking of Ballard, the studio where it was recorded was called Hanzik Audio, right there on Leary Way.
Yeah, it was in Ballard. It was a concrete block that had no visible features or charm. It was just like something that might have been designed to be bulletproof. It had a coffee machine and it had ants. I remember somehow the ants had come up through the floor. I remember seeing a little trail of ants wandering around.
Now, longtime Seattle audio guy Chris Hanzik built the studio in that ancient concrete building. He says it originally housed a rectifier for the street railway, so it's a historic location just on its own. He operated his studio there until 2005. He loves that Viva SeaTac was recorded at Hanzik Audio. And he gets that recording studios are like supporting characters in so many cool stories about music, like Muscle Shoals in Alabama, Sun in Memphis, or maybe Abbey Road in London.
The fact that the music existed is due in small part to the fact that the studio existed. You know, they're kind of like mothers that give birth to little things that then grow up to be bigger things. So thanks for recognizing that.
Now, Scott McCoy, who plays guitar and keyboards for the Young Fresh Fellows, he played bass on Viva SeaTac, not an instrument he normally plays. Now, on the recording, I asked Scott, it sounds like you guys are just having a lot of fun.
We were. We had a blast. It was so fun. It was a really no pressure kind of session. I don't know. It just felt like it was super fun.
You know, Kurt Block is a founder of the Fastbacks. He's a member of the Young Fresh Fellows and is mainly a guitarist. He was thrilled to be invited to play with Robin Hitchcock, who he'd idolized since the 70s. But then he realized that they wanted him to play keyboards.
Well, you realize that I'm not a
keyboard player. that's okay. We'll work all that stuff out. And all of a sudden, it turned in from being the most exciting thing to like the most panicked, weird thing of all time. And I was like, well, you guys, do you have any like tapes of the songs we're gonna do or anything like that so I can prepare in any way?
You know, the answer was no, but Kurt needn't have worried. He's a talented musician and the keyboards sound great, and that's what Pete Gerald says, who was audio engineer for that session.
And we just knocked it out. It was very kind of fun and low key. It was no pressure at all. It was just really fun. Probably did it on the third take and that was it. It was pretty straightforward. And then we may have done a backing track and may have dubbed a couple little things, but it's pretty much live.
So that's why it gets that sort of live sound. And Pete, you know, also was engineer on Sicko's version of Washington, My Home, and a song we play a lot here in these history segments. And speaking of history, you know, did Scott McCoy have any idea people would still be talking about Viva SeaTac 25 years later?
I knew when we did it, I go, this is really cool. Like, I could see this really, like, people at least around here, it'd be like a smash hit, you know?
Now, let's hear the ending of the song. It has a bit of a spoken word blessing or benediction for the people of Washington State.
I heard Space Needle.
Yeah, he talks about the Space Needle, such a nice guy. The Space Needle points to the sky. Now, one last thing I asked Robin, if he would be happy to receive some kind of formal recognition, maybe to designate Viva SeaTac as the official song about Seattle written by an Englishman.
I don't know how many English men have written songs about Seattle. It's probably a limited pool, so I might well come first. I'd be thrilled if somebody wanted to put a plaque on it, you know, and say, this here is Robin Hitchcock's contribution to our great folk culture.
So he's playing this Friday night at the Neptune Theater. That song is probably going to be played. Kurt Block's playing guitar, not keyboard, so everyone should be very happy. No panic. But it's a great local anthem that hopefully by doing this today, we're kind of cementing its future as a thing people will always turn to for inspiration.
Well, the legislature's still in session, so there's still time. Felix Bunnell, all his features at MyNorthwest.com. Thank you, Felix.
Thanks, Dave.
6:49, Seattle's Morning News. More now from our conversation with New York Times reporter Christina Goldbaum, who is stationed in Kabul and wanted to document the ordeal that women who live under Taliban rule have to go through. One question we have for Christina, how can any woman hope to raise a daughter under a regime that this is oppressive, that is this oppressive towards women?
I mean, I've talked to women who are now more worried about having, especially girls, but also that's not just about the restrictions on women's rights. It's also the economic collapse that the country has experienced over the last year and a half. You know, after the U.S. withdrew, sanctions on the new government, all of that, the jobs that suddenly disappeared once, Western forces were not in Afghanistan, all of that contributed to this massive humanitarian crisis that we have seen play out over the last year and a half. And so I think a lot of women now, when they're thinking about having kids, the main question to them is, will I be able to feed my children? Because even right now, it is incredibly difficult. Joblessness is pervasive across the country. The prices of food and other basic necessities has shot up. And as we've seen, women tend to think more about how to feed, how to provide for their family. If there is a household that is stressed, women will give up their food to their children, more so than, men, according to a lot of aid organizations. So I think that's actually the first thing that's on a lot of women's minds right now. And one of the most recent policies that barred women from working in NGOs, that's also really, made it much more difficult for NGOs to work across the country. There has been a big debate around whether Western donors feel comfortable, continuing to donate to aid organizations that are providing, food that is keeping millions of people alive in Afghanistan right now, given this policy. And they question whether that is a red line that violates humanitarian principles, working without women in these organizations. So that's kind of thrown into question over the last 2 months since the policy was enacted. What will be the future of this humanitarian crisis? Will, big UN agencies be able to continue providing life-saving aid or not because of this policy barring women from working in NGOs. And even for organizations that have continued to try and provide aid, it's been very difficult because women, you know, tend to, especially in rural areas, only interact with other women or men in their households. So if there is a food distribution and there's only men distributing food, it means that women are much less likely to go to that distribution and get food for their families. So again, I think kind of top of mind right now for women in terms of, you know, surviving and the future of Afghanistan and having kids, it's really just basic questions of will they be able to feed their family because it is so incredibly difficult to right now.
Did you feel safe while in Afghanistan or were there any close calls?
Yeah, I mean, I've been working in Afghanistan, you know, before the Taliban seized power, and I've been there, you know, pretty consistently afterwards. I think as a Western woman, I am afforded, you know, many kind of carve outs to a lot of these exemptions to be able to work. But it is, you know, I have definitely seen, especially in Kabul over the last, you know, year and last couple of months, even the kind of erasure of women from public spaces.
I still don't understand the psychology of the Taliban.
Yeah.
This policy dooms them to extinction. So who's calling the shots here? And at some point, wouldn't there be an internal attempt to overthrow this regime when they realize that they're basically going to die out?
I think what we've seen over the last couple of months, you know, I guess when the Taliban first seized power, there was this kind of period, you know, maybe 6 months or so of a bit of uncertainty, right? Like you saw, you know, some of these high ranking officials who were more prone to try to, you know, moderate more of these hardline policies in order to engage with the world. And these are officials who recognized that, you know, girls needed to attend school in order to, you know, have other countries recognize this government. Still no country has recognized the Taliban as, you know, the official government of Afghanistan. And so there was this kind of period where, you know, it seems like maybe that those members of leadership would win out and some of these more hardline policies would be moderated. Girls would be able to go to school, which is kind of a barometer for, you know, how this government was going to rule. And then what we saw, you know, first last March was the kind of first inkling of what was to come. And that was the more hardline top leadership, the emir of this government that's based in Kandahar in the south, it's kind of the birthplace of the Taliban movement, taking the reins and first barred girls from attending secondary schools. And then what we've seen in the last couple of months is, again, this kind of very ultra-conservative leadership that's based in the south, really taking the reins even more and looking for other ways to kind of erase women from public spaces and try to keep women in their home. And so we've seen some pushback to that. I think the issue of women's rights has been probably the most divisive within this government. The way that the Taliban operates, the way that this government operates, is this kind of adherence to the emir, the, you know, the supreme leader of the government's policies. There is this sense of we need to at least outwardly show that there is unity and we need to adhere to any policy put forth by the emir. And I think we've begun to see cracks in that in the last couple of months as some of these more controversial policies when it comes to women working in NGOs and attending universities have come into place. And so we've seen the more moderate leadership that's especially based in Kabul beginning to speak out more publicly, saying that girls should be able to attend schools. And so some of those cracks that were, you know, internal divisions for a couple of months are now kind of spilling into the public view.
New York Times reporter Christina Goldbaum, her piece is called Loss Piles on Loss for Afghan Women. Christina, thank you.
Thank you.
Now to update us on what's happening in Olympia, Cairo News Radio's Matt Markovich. We're going to talk about catalytic converters, car insurance, car tabs, but we also have a new revenue forecast, Matt.
Yeah, I brought this up, Dave, because of the governor came on our air a couple weeks ago. You interviewed him, and he talked about an alternative to this $4 billion tax levy that he's proposing to go to voters this November to pay for housing. But he had said that maybe we wouldn't have to go to a vote if the tax revenues are going to be improving. And guess what? They have been. They just came out with this report that the state over the last month or so collected $110 million more than it anticipated. That's a 6.2% increase over the forecast and basically $200 million extra so far this year. So I bring this up because this is what lawmakers are looking at. how do we spend this extra money? Obviously, Republicans say, let's give it back. But the Democrats are saying, how are we going to do this? And so there's going to be a big push before the budget now on how you're going to spend this extra money. Do you pay for housing now and avoid a vote? So I just thought that I'd bring that up based on the conversation you had with the governor.
We don't know if this is enough to satisfy the governor.
Say what?
We don't know still if this is enough to satisfy the governor.
We don't know. Yeah. But obviously, the state is bringing in more revenue than it had forecasted. Yeah. I mean, it was forecasted to be higher, but now it's even higher than what was forecasted. So
higher than high. That's
cool. Yeah. So that, I thought I'd just bring that up. That just happened.
All right, let's talk auto insurance now.
Yeah, auto insurance. So there's a bill now that you must show proof of liability auto insurance when you register by January 1st, 2026. And people are saying, well, if we're going to have to show proof of registration when you go get your tabs, renew your tabs, or even when you buy a new car, how are you going to do this? So they're talking about a real-time online verification system, establishing it so that people who renew your tabs at those licensing shops, as well as police, have real-time information on whether or not you really do have automobile insurance. And one of the reasons why they want to push this is they want to get cut down on the number of uninsured drivers. A couple of years ago, according to the experts that testified, you know, we had basically one out of every 25 drivers had no auto insurance. Mm. Now it's one out of five. Gene Leonard represents the Washington State insurers.
We found in other states where they do require verification of insurance that the rate of uninsured drivers goes down. So we're hoping to carry this forward into Washington State.
Now, when you go buy a new car, you usually don't have to show proof of insurance right when you buy a new car. So Scott Hazelgrove represents the Washington Auto Dealers Association. He likes the idea, but dealers need to be included in this online system. Right now, they're not.
To be caught in a situation where they will be driving a vehicle for a month and a half that they thought they purchased, only to find out that their plates and registration are actually not going to show up because there was some kind of question about whether their insurance verification was accurate.
So it's leaving new car buyers in limbo. Now, if dealers are not going to be included in the system, he says there's an alternative.
This bill could be applied at the time of renewal only. That would be a time when consumers actually did have insurance on the vehicle that they're driving. Consumers rarely put insurance on a vehicle right as they're driving it off the lot.
Yeah, and so we all have to have auto insurance in this state. It's mandatory. So they're trying to maybe crack down on that. And it's an idea that's a pretty good idea. Now, whether it's going to fly this year, I don't know. But it's passed. It's passed the Senate, I believe, and it's in the House. And also, as a footnote, the state insurance commissioner yesterday announced a rule change that insurance companies going forward would have to provide easy-to-understand language why an insurance premium is going to be changing at the time of renewal. They have to say why it's going up, and they have to say why it's going down. So when you make a decision about your auto insurance or homeowners insurance, you can make an informed decision. They're going to have a hearing on that in April. So that's kind of like a sidebar to this insurance issue.
Okay, catalytic converters. What's the latest on that?
Well, here's a bill that I personally think it's not going to fly. It did not go through the normal channels. It's the first time it's presented. We've been talking for weeks about how this process works. Yeah. And out of the blue, the Republicans were allowed to put this in front of a committee. And basically, it requires every person involved in purchasing a catalytic converter that's been removed from a car, they have to have a valid scrap metal or vehicle records license. And Republican Jeff Wilson is the bill's sponsor, explains what's at the core of these thefts.
To me, it's PPR, platinum, platinum, and rhodium. Three very precious metals worth a lot of money. So much money that it elevates these crimes and it attracts organized crimes.
So his proposal is to license legitimate scrap metal recyclers and license only those guys who are allowed to buy converters.
You can buy these, but you have to be a licensed auto or scrap metal recycler. And that is a really good step in deterring crime that you may not have caught first underneath the car, but you can catch later on during the transaction.
So during the testimony, he got no supporters because, one, there's an existing law that took effect last year that allows scrappers to basically, or they're mandatory, mandating scrappers to record every transaction involving a catalytic converter. You have to record the VIN number. You have to get the guy's license plate, as well as the license information of the driver who's coming in to sell that scrap. Basically, James King of the Independent Business Association spoke on behalf of the auto industry, and he didn't like it.
This bill is a terrible misfire. You need to listen to the experts that spent months working on proposals. This bill does not reflect that. In fact, this bill would make the problem worse.
Why would it make it worse?
Because the Dave Ross can go in and get a scrap metal license and say, hey, I got my license here to buy this stuff.
So there's no standards in who gets the license?
Well, I mean, that's what it's alluding to. It's like, okay, you're going to get these licenses, and if you just have a business, who's going to come out and check that you're actually a scrap metal dealer?
I thought each converter had to have a valid VIN number that accompanies it, so you could actually
I recall that, too. I'm not up to speed on that, but yes, you're correct. But they're cracking down on at the legitimate places. But here's Taylor Gardner. She represents the Washington Association of Sheriffs and Police Chiefs, and she explains how hard it is to catch a catalytic converter thief if you really don't see them underneath a car.
And the reality is there's a severe lack of tools available to law enforcement to do something when they come across an average Joe on the street with five catalytic converters, detached catalytic converters in the back of their car. And it's simply because existing theft laws just don't work here. You can't assume something's stolen, but when you don't have a victim to tie to a crime, you can't prove that there's been a theft either.
Yeah, but that was the idea of the VIN numbers, so that, yeah, of course, you can't have cops looking under cars all the time, but you can make it impossible to sell one of these stolen converters, which takes the money out of it.
Correct. I believe that, I mean, they're pushing for that. But that's why I think that's why I brought this bill up. It didn't go through the normal channels.
Yeah.
It people want to see some action on catalytic converter theft. This was in the rears for quite a while, and they've just brought it forward. But already, because it didn't get much support, I don't think it's going to happen. But there's obviously a cry to fix this problem. This may not be the solution.
All right. Matt Markovich. Thank you, Matt.
You're welcome.
Time for your daily dose of kindness, brought to you by Robert W. Baird. A mother in Nebraska wants to make sure the memory of her son is never forgotten, and she's doing it one random act of kindness at a time. In 2021, Nicole Adams' son, Jordan, died by suicide. She tells KETV in Omaha,
I did not know that he was having troubles. And when I found out about it, it was already too late. He was just all around a special kid.
She's now turning that tragedy into acts of service, including to fellow Walmart shoppers. Hope Spicer says she was just standing in line when she realized the person in front of her paid for her son's medication and some cupcakes.
She handed me this card and she said, this is how I keep my son's memory alive.
In hopes of thanking the stranger, Hope posted what happened along with a picture of the card on Facebook. Someone commented with Nicole's name, and the two women were able to meet. Hope was able to say thank you.
It touched my heart deeply, and I shed a few tears.
Nicole says she didn't realize she made that big of an impact, but says that's just what her son would have done.
He helped an old lady that had her battery die and got jumper cables, went and bought them with his last $8 and gave them to her and made sure she got home.
And she not only wants to help other members of her community, but other grieving parents as well.
I feel like after a child is lost, they're forgotten. And I refuse to let my child be forgotten.
And that's left a lasting mark on at least one person, Hope Spicer.
I'm going to keep that card in my wallet with me. So every time I go to the store, I see it when I pull out my debit card.
.748 now from the Gian Ursula Show. It starts at 9. Here's G. Scott. It's March, but we're still talking football news. Why is that?
He's moving over here because he has no headphones at that desk. Oh. Yeah.
Here, I'll tell you what I said. Why are we talking football in March?
Because the Seattle Seahawks are having an incredible offseason. This offseason... Have you ever been having something just go so well, like whether your job or your relationship?
That always scares me.
Yes. Right?
Yeah. The hammer's about to drop.
Right?
That's right? Yeah.
That's what's happening right now with the Seattle Seahawks. This offseason is so good. You go 12 months ago, March 15th, which is the date. How was the Seahawks feeling March 15th? I'll tell you, there's a lot of people like, oh, they just traded Russell Wilson. Bobby Wagner's gone. Oh, my goodness. What are we going to do? Well, we only have Geno Smith. And now here we are a year later.
We've signed him.
You signed Geno Smith.
He wrote back.
You just signed Draymond Jones, who played at the Ohio State University by way of, then he went to the Denver Broncos. He was an excellent defensive lineman. He is now a free agent signing. And so somebody's probably asking, well, gee, just how good is Draymond Jones? I'll tell you. Since John and Pete have been here, Draymond Jones now is the highest amount of money they have spent on a free agent as far as a yearly average since they've been here.
Wow. And what's his job again?
Defensive lineman.
He protects Geno Smith.
No. He goes after.
Oh, he goes after the other guy.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So he plays defense, but he got a 3-year, $51 million contract.
Mm-hmm. So
nice. I'm not the best with math, but that rocks out about 17, mm-hmm. right? $17 million a year.
So it must be pretty good.
And then the Seahawks weren't done. Yesterday, they brought back a defensive lineman who's really good. He was drafted by the Seahawks about 6-7 years ago. Jaron Reed. Reed is back for the Seattle Seahawks. And they still got more money to spend. And they still have the number 5 pick and the number 20 pick here in the NFL draft. Colleen, Dave, things going too good right now.
So did Russell's lack of results help us out this year, or was that just the cherry on top?
Oh, yeah. I mean, Russell and them, I want to call it a team effort. The Denver Broncos, right? The Denver Broncos made it possible for the Seattle Seahawks to have the number 5 pick in the draft, which it is shaping up, you know, what are the Seahawks going to do with that pick? Huh? The way it's looking like there might be 3 quarterbacks chosen in the first 5 picks. You have C.J. Stroud, you have Anthony Richardson, and you have Bryce Young. I think C.J. Stroud is going to go number 1, the Ohio State, by the way. He's going to go to number 1 to the Carolina Panthers, I believe that. I believe that Bryce Young will go number 2. And there's other, the Arizona Cardinals are in there too. Well, the Arizona Cardinals don't need a quarterback, right? The Arizona Cardinals already have Kyler Murray and a quarterback, so it might shape up to where the Seahawks might get a quarterback. Who knows?
I thought Drew Lock was the backup.
Is that
his name? Drew Lock?
Yeah, Drew Lock. He is the backup. But when you have an opportunity to get one of these quarterbacks, and I think getting one of these three quarterbacks is a real big deal. Even when you do have Geno Smith, you got a guy right there. Remember how they did Patrick Mahomes? Well, I'll tell you. Patrick Mahomes sat behind Alex Smith his first year. So sometimes it's not that bad to sit behind a quarterback. Aaron Rodgers sat behind Brett Favre for some time. Steve Young sat behind Joe Montana. So sometimes it's good to draft a quarterback and keep him.
I saw the name Bobby Wagner mentioned.
Yeah, I mean, that's a possibility. I think Bobby wants to come on home.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah. I changed my mind on that one because I didn't think that he wanted to come back. Now I have a feeling that he does want to come back, and I think that if the Seattle Seahawks can make it happen, it'll happen, unless someone else comes out there, because it's also been reported by Ed Warner that that the Dallas Cowboys are slipping and creeping up in his DMs.
So how old is he again?
Why you always be asking about age,
because
man?
You tell me it's important.
Because they're so young.
No, I don't ask you your age. I think Bobby Wagner like 32,
I know he's
33. How old is he?
Who?
I know I'm asking, Colleen. How old is he?
Who, Bobby Wagner?
Yeah, Bobby Wagner. How old is he?
I have no idea.
Oh, Bobby Wagner? How long has he been in the NFL?
Oh, come on, man. I don't know.
Okay.
2012.
I'm going to say he's 31.
Yeah, I say he's like 31, 32.
All right, I'll look it up.
Yeah, yeah.
I thought you were about to ask me Dave's age, and I was like, do I say it in front of
Dave? No.
It's not something, you should never, ever care about revealing your age, but I won't reveal personal information without Dave's permission.
If we're at a party, Colleen,
yeah.
And I just meet, oh, hello, Colleen, nice to meet you. So how old are you? Is that a good idea? You tell me.
It depends on the social situation. If you're asking me my age at a party,
yeah.
That's creepy.
Bobby is 32 years old. His birthday is June 27th.
Spot on.
Oh, okay, real quick.
Yeah.
You said it's creepy.
Yeah.
Isn't it creepy to say, hey, so what do you do? What, is that creepy?
Asking about your job. No, I don't think that's creepy. No. That's a point of interest.
You could do more damage, do more bad stuff knowing where someone works and what they do than
unless
their age.
Unless they lie about what they do. Sometimes I do just because I don't want to answer any more questions about the news.
It.
When you say you work in the news, it conversations that follow
it
are
changes
just
completely.
Painful, isn't it?
Yeah.
One of the most common thing people say is, well, I don't watch the news. Right. I'm like, good, you can listen.
I tell them I work in home maintenance.
There you go. Yeah.
That's what I do most of the time.
Nobody wants, or accounting. Nobody wants follow-up questions
on
that.
G. Scott, 9 o'clock. See you later.
You're listening to Seattle's Morning News. I'm Chris Sullivan. It feels like self-driving cars have been right around the corner for a decade. Elon Musk said in 2016 he'd have a Tesla that could drive itself coast to coast by 2017. And the Governor Inslee ordered the Department of Licensing, the DOT, and the State Patrol to get ready to handle self-driving vehicles on Washington roadways. Stories about self-driving cars tend to fade into the background until one crashes. Last month, Tesla issued a recall of more than 300,000 cars because of problems with their self-driving software. Now the state and some cities have been working on plans for the future of self-driving cars and trucks and vehicles of all types. Cairo News Radio's Lisa Brooks has been looking into all of this, and things are moving forward pretty quickly.
Especially in the Seattle and Bellevue areas, transportation teams from the two cities spent more than a year looking at pretty much every aspect of self-driving cars or automated vehicles. I'll be calling them AVs for short. They wanted to find out what kinds of rules would be needed to operate them, what the public thinks about AVs, if city streets can actually handle them, how safe they'd be, just about every use and contingency. And these two teams combine their efforts, they say, to release their joint strategic vision for AVs in Seattle and Bellevue. That's the official name. They just presented their findings to the Washington Transportation Commission. So I spoke with Daniel Lai. He is the project lead with the city of Bellevue about what they're doing and learned how we might realistically see AVs first come into actual use.
Perhaps like a circulator of sorts. You know, some of these circulators, we've seen them on private campuses before around the nation, medical complexes.
And most likely after that,
some of the earlier applications of AVs will likely be in the form factor of ride hail services. We know that there's been a lot of active deployments in other states like California and Arizona as well.
So it sounds like these are the kind of things when they talk like a circular, I'd imagine it like the UW campus where you've kind of got these cars going around in that pattern, right, where you can drive cars, but they'd be on a hailing basis, so a student in Red Square could go grab one, maybe take it down to a certain part, get to the library, or back and forth. Is that kind of what we're talking about?
Yeah, that's why I asked Daniel that question. He says that kind of thing he thinks is going to happen at least in limited areas pretty soon.
I think those are within 5 years, I would say. There's good data points, good examples of those two applications already happening in other cities across the nation.
And those are pilot program shuttle services. They're operating right now in like Grand Rapids, Minnesota, and Greensboro, North Carolina.
Yeah, and that's one of the things, Lisa, that kind of scares me about this, and maybe a lot of people, is okay, doing it on a campus or doing it on a closed course is one thing. How am I going to be sharing my drive with a self-driving car next to me, or how close am I to getting a self-driving car?
Yeah, very good question. It does not sound like that's where we are.
Every estimate of when AVs would come to our roadway, public roadways, has been wrong thus far. You know, the data has always been pushed back.
Now, Daniel says there is testing happening right now. So maybe you've seen them, those Zoox cars. Those are Amazon.
Yeah,
the self-driving cars. They're like SUVs. They're being tested on Seattle streets right now. And these are mostly automated. They're listed as level 3 out of 5 levels. And the Society of Automotive Engineers makes that designation. They have to have a driver behind the wheel who can take control if conditions need it. Otherwise, these cars are driving themselves, but there apparently is not a lot of testing happening everywhere else in Washington. And we're hearing that some cities have even banned it outright. But most haven't even started to address the issue. And that's a big problem, according to Daniel. He says he's concerned the technology is going to be ready before communities can handle them.
If we don't manage the technology, there's a good chance that some of those goals may not be met. And those goals relate to safety, sustainability, providing equitable transportation.
And what's interesting is the fact, like you mentioned about the state, the certification process already in place at the state level. So the Washington Department of Licensing is already telling AV companies, yeah, you can go ahead and test. I talked to Bo Pershberger about that. He is the legislative and policy director for the Department of Licensing.
If you're operating anywhere in Washington, you have to self-certify if you're doing testing. If you're operating in specific local jurisdictions that require regulation, you must comply with those regulations.
And that means any city that's actually banned testing is ahead of the game here.
The state program allows you to operate statewide, but locals are authorized under the law to impose their own regulations in their specific jurisdictions.
Now, the good news, according to Daniel Lai and the Bellevue Seattle study, there's no hard deadline for this, at least not yet.
Thankfully, we have some time because there's not been a company that's signaled to at least Bellevue that they're going to be bringing any commercial operations here. But we've seen a lot of other deployments across the nation that are helping us to formulate our ideas and different policies around managing AVs.
Yeah, Lisa, in your research and looking into this, I think a lot of people are concerned, well, how is my car going to tell the difference between a pedestrian walking in front of me versus a street light? And how fast are we going to get around that mentally to be able to be comfortable with that? Because that seems like a big leap to me that until they can prove that they're 100% safe, I'm not sure I want them on the road sharing with bicyclists or pedestrians or me out running or anything like that.
Yeah, that's a big part of what they're testing right now. They have all of these parameters and all of these benchmarks these vehicles have to meet. And there's even plans in the Seattle and Bellevue study for redesigning city streets completely so they can handle pedestrian lanes and bike lanes and then autonomous vehicle lanes.
And also, I think one thing that's really important, too, we had talked a little bit when you mentioned the different stage, the stage three is what we're talking about, to kind of set the playing field here. Like level one and level two AVs are kind of like people that have a car that's got a really good eyesight system that maybe handles your cruise control and slows you down or maybe stops the car a little bit. Three is where we are. But I think most people think that we're four or five right now, stage four or five, where you get in the car, you put on the music and you go to bed. And it just, you wake up where you land. And that's just not where we are. And we're not going to be there for a long time.
Well, not even close, we don't think. But what is interesting is the technology is going to be ready first. And unless these communities enact some sort of regulation saying we don't want the testing on the streets, the documentation for the state is already in place. And these tests can begin now for level four and level five vehicles, unless cities and communities set rules.
8:49. America has a proud history of bored, hungry, demanding people who, when wow. they dine out, put a premium on accuracy and authenticity in their food. And when they eat at Buffalo Wild Wings, they expect Buffalo Wild Wings. And Mickey Gomez is here to point out that they're not wings. They're not made of buffalo meat.
And nope.
Are they wild, at least?
They are not wild. A Chicago man is really upset, and he is suing Buffalo Wild Wings because the wings are made with chicken breast meat.
That's crazy.
Say no more. He ate
Chicago
their
Chicago man. Just say no more.
So according to the lawsuit, Buffalo Wild Wings is apparently dressing up chicken breast and calling it a wing.
A boneless wing?
It's okay. A boneless wing. And apparently this is, it might be considered consumer fraud. The guy is, yes. I know. I want to get his name right. Ayman Halim of Chicago is the man who filed the lawsuit on Friday. He says he went to a Buffalo Wild Wings in Illinois back in January, and he was ready to dig in on some boneless wings, and he noticed there weren't any bones
feathers
in them.
Well, oh, no, bones.
And that
the meat was white, which, hello?
Yeah.
How does, wing is white meat, right?
Does he think that they deconstruct the wing, removing the bones, and then cover it in sauce? Is that what he thought?
Probably.
There's no way.
Probably. What a- but Buffalo Wild Wings did send out a cheeky tweet, which I thought was really cool. They wrote, "It's true. Our boneless wings are all white meat chicken. Our hamburgers contain no ham. Our buffalo wings are 0% buffalo." So good on you, Buffalo Wild Wings.
There
so,
must have been a description underneath the boneless wings. All white meat chicken breasts.
I don't know.
On the menu, no?
I'm going to have to look. Okay. I've never even... I mean, even I knew that it wasn't buffalo meat and that it wasn't a wing.
Because there's no such thing as a boneless wing, people.
Right. How do you not know this? Yeah. But, you know...
Wait a minute. Yes. So there's no such thing as a flying buffalo either? Is that what you're telling
well,
me now?
No, I mean, such there, thing as a flying pig
here's
either.
Here's the
but.
Thing, though. False advertising. Buffalo Wild Wings little mascot is a buffalo with wings.
This well, is true. But I, when so. I think of Buffalo Wild Wings, I think of their hot sauce. You know, I sure. think of the that's where the buffalo is coming
it's
from.
Called it's called buffalo
just,
sauce.
Yeah, it's buffalo yeah. sauce. So I'm not taking them for their word. But anyway, Halim is seeking unspecified damages. No word on whether or not this is going to be thrown out of court. But you may remember that there were a couple of other wild, frivolous lawsuits. One of them was the Subway tuna lawsuit after DNA tests were done.
Gross.
And scientists couldn't identify tuna as one of the ingredients in the Subway tuna sandwich.
It was some sort of fish, though.
Was it?
It just wasn't tuna.
Okay. I don't know about that. But Starbucks that was sued because of the amount of ice they place in a drink. One customer said that they felt the more the ice, the less the coffee.
You know something I've noticed? You go into a Subway and there are no trains there.
That's just...
Did you know that?
Well,
no turnstiles either.
There's no trains.
There's no metro car.
They used to have like newspaper and subway tile. Remember
right.
back in the day?
Yes.
Those
yeah.
were good. Those were well-decorated
well,
restaurants.
Subway was sued again for their $5 footlong. I don't know if you remember this one, but an Australian teen wanted to measure and see if the footlong was actually a foot long.
Uh-huh.
So he took out the measuring tape, took a picture with the measured sandwich, and it was an inch too short.
It's an 11 inch long.
It's an 11 inch long, you know, Subway sandwich. But yeah, a lot of people are suing. You may remember that McDonald's was sued because of the hot coffee.
Yeah,
hot
that,
coffee
that
was
lady
too hot.
I remember that.
Yeah, I remember she did win. So
yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah, but at least McDonald's is run by a guy named McDonald.
Is that true?
Is it? No, it's not.
It's not?
No.
No.
Well, no.
Darn it.
No, it's not.
Nor was its creator.
No, yeah, exactly.
McDonald.
Well, no, it was the McDonald brothers. But then it was, but then they.
Oh, the other guy took it and marketed it and
exactly.
bought it from them. That is correct.
Well, it should be called Crocs then, right?
Crocs, because they're not crocodiles?
No, Ray Kroc.
Oh, Ray Kroc. Oh, okay. Yes.
By the way, Crocs are not made from crocodiles either. Did you know that?
I'm glad. Happy to hear that. Mm. But at any rate, so people must have a lot of time on their hands and they're really upset. And he's going after Buffalo Wild Wings. And
yeah. Now I'm going to eat wings because I'm hungry for buffalo wings.
I'm going to order some for lunch because now I'm craving the blue cheese dressing.
Yes.
I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News.
You can hear us live every morning on 97.3 FM or subscribe to this podcast and you'll never miss the show.